producer.
Your video production assistant, so it's all good.
All right. Excellent. Send you my bill. I knew I should have got the unpaid PA for a reason.
No, we're going to pay you in Game Crafter coupons.
Right.
We're paying everyone.
Yeah. Hey, I use my Crafter coins. All right. Well, welcome to running your board game Kickstarter. I'll say that if you're an indie guy and that's the route you want to go, it's the route a lot of guys go. There's plenty of mistakes to make there that could cost you a lot of money. So hopefully what you get out of this panel is how to avoid those mistakes so that you do not go into the red, because so many people do. My name is Jeremy Commander. I'll be kind of our moderator. I co-host with Brian and one other person the BoardGame.Business podcast. It's all about the back end of board games, things to do preparing for your Kickstarter or afterwards in terms of fulfillment and things like that. If you want to check that out, it's at BoardGame.Business, and it gives you a lot of the same lessons we're going to talk about today. Zachary Strebeck is the game lawyer, and his podcast is called The Legal Moves Podcast.
It is, and I've done 43 episodes. I think 35 of them have been people who have run Kickstarters, and we always talk about it.
There we go. And so if you were looking at more information about artist contracts, things like licensing your game to other countries, things like that, then he's your great resource for that. Brian Hank runs Overworld Games. They have done 6 successful Kickstarters now.
Yep.
6 successful Kickstarters that funded and made their goal, and hopefully they all made money. some were close, but they all made money.
Yeah.
And so Brian can talk for the lessons learned along the way. He's learned a lot of hard lessons. Their new game at the show is called Exposed, which was funded on Kickstarter and is debuting in sort of retail here at the show. Mm-hmm. And then JT Smith, who runs the Game Crafter and maybe is your best friend for Kickstarter, because if you're going to take your game to Kickstarter, you want to plan at different levels. Like, well, if I get this many backers, I want to print with a Game Crafter, and they're going to do my printing and fulfillment, and my game will get out there, and it will make it, even if I have a low amount of backers. And if you have a ton of backers, you're going to graduate from the Game Crafter to a larger print run. But the Game Crafter is a great way to do that. Also, I like to mention that before you do your Kickstarter, you should make review copies of your games that go out to various reviewers, and the easiest way to do that is through the Game Crafter, is that you make the review copies, ship them out to all the reviewers, so you have reviewers doing videos and written reviews before your Kickstarter of your game to get you more buzz and to get you more eyeballs.
And these little gift cards that are around here, you cannot stack them, but this will give you $5 off your first purchase of the Game Crafter. So.
And as JT pointed out, you can redeem it right of way, so it goes in your account and spend it later.
That's right.
There we go. So I want to start out by asking the panel here, from your perspective, let's say the legal perspective, the small publisher perspective, the production fulfillment perspective, what's the number one biggest mistake you see a small indie guy go when they go do their first Kickstarter? So I'm going to start with what's a big common mistake you see people go and they do their Kickstarter and you're like, oh man. They didn't come talk to you first. What did they do?
Right. Maybe not forming a company before they go to Kickstarter. I would like, as the lawyer, ultimately the Kickstarter be in the LLC or the company's name rather than you individually. That way, if something gets screwed up and the Washington state government or the federal government sues you or something, which has happened a couple times in the last year, you don't personally want to be liable for that. Although I think in both of those cases, they were personally liable because they saw it as fraudulent. So I think they can go after you individually.
Or the guy who did the black box door to Rome and lost his house.
Yeah, exactly. You want to avoid things like that.
Yeah. Brian, that's like the number one mistake that springs to your mind that if you're going to do my indie publisher, going to do my first Kickstarter, what's the thing? That, oh, man.
There's so many. I know your favorite, so I think after JT we can maybe get the super backer and game designer biggest mistake that you've seen that you think.
Yeah, it's a big one.
But for me, I guess I'll go with not completely understanding shipping and fulfillment after the campaign. So you need to understand that better than any part of your campaign. Don't just assume like, oh, this campaign or these 10 campaigns charge this amount. That's what I'm going to charge. I'm going to be fine. Each game is so different. The box size, the weights, everything is very, very different. And the method you use to fulfill your Kickstarter needs to fit your game. So you need to understand that better than anything. And if you don't, you're asking for trouble.
JT, what's the number one mistake you see that indie guy goes to Kickstarter?
I know.
Yeah. There's thousands of ways to screw it up. Shipping, I totally agree with. That's probably my actual number one, but I'll go with the second one that I see very commonly. First-time game designers that go for a ridiculous budget. They're like, I'm going to get $100,000. And more importantly, they try to do that without reviewers or any kind of third-party anything verifying that this thing is any good at all.
But wait, so, when people see their project, they'll love it, right?
And yeah. Yeah. The fanfare, no one can see the fanfare that's the going to exist just because you created this thing and brought it into the world.
Right.
As is commonly said, you try to crowdfund without a crowd, right? That's right. Is that kind of that?
Yep.
Similar.
All right. I mentioned, I think, before, I'm a Kickstarter super backer. I have a little badge. My wheel of pie is complete. If you use Kickstarter a lot, you know what that means. I backed probably about 400 Kickstarter projects, and it's four something, and most of them board games. And so the number one thing I see that sinks the first-time creator or the indie creator or second-time creator is stretch goals. The stretch goals eat them alive. Because what happened was they did not plan all their stretch goals before their campaign, or they planned how much they were going to cost to produce, but not that – now their package weighs more, and they go into a new shipping bracket that just ate their margin. Or it won't fit in the flat rate box anymore because the stretch goals add extra components, and now their package has to be bigger. And so I've seen so many campaigns where the stretch goals destroyed the profitability of that game or delayed it months and months and months. Or some games that I backed years ago have never been made because they went bananas with the stretch goals and it ate them alive. So I as a super backer, I say on the podcast, I hate stretch goals and they're a turnoff for me. When I go to a Kickstarter campaign and I go, oh, they have 8 pre-announced stretch goals. I'm not going to touch this one. That's a fire waiting to happen. And so that is not exciting for me. I may probably in the minority of that, that a lot of people love stretch goals, but you need to be very careful with them because they are a double-edged sword.
Will not having stretch goals affect – maybe I'm jumping ahead, but will that affect your ability to fund, do you think? Or do you think people ultimately don't care?
You need to plan to fund without stretch goals. Like, hey, if I'm going to fund, you know, and so like, so Jamie Stegmaier says you need to have 3 plans, but this is the, I just barely fund, I kind of moderately fund, or I go bananas and did better than my wildest dreams. Mm-hmm. And you need to have all 3 of those in a spreadsheet. And so, yeah, I just barely fund, I've got it all priced out, I'm going to do the Game Crafter to print and fulfill it, my game's out there in the market. Now I can take it to cons. I can try to get some awards, some accolades, and maybe do a bigger print run. I'm moderately funded. I can print with Panda now. I can do a larger print run and try to get into retail. Or better than my wildest dreams, woohoo! Now my game's a huge hit, and I have lots of options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you don't get it right, and you either don't understand shipping, or you if you have a bunch of stretch goals that increase your shipping, you can easily be off by $5, you know, per copy. And if you do go crazy and fund and get 2,000 backers, you just made a $10,000 mistake. And you need to come up with that $10,000. It didn't come from your Kickstarter campaign. So I hope you have that laying around.
I think Vinyl Dragon on their website, they have a case study about their first Kickstarter. And they went $40,000 in the hole afterwards, the lessons they learned. So that's worth reading that case study about, we did stretch goals and we paid all this money up front for art and then we didn't calculate our shipping properly and we made negative $40,000. And so, but they survived that. So it's worth looking at.
I want to add an overarching.
A Vinyl Dragon.
Yeah. I want to add an overarching theme to this whole thing. And that is the reason that Kickstarters fail most often is simply because the person that put up the Kickstarter did not treat it as a business. This is a business. Kickstarter is a business. It may only be a business that lasts for 1 year of your life, but it is a business, and you need to treat it as such. Therefore, you need to have budgets. You need to have accounting. You need to do customer service. All of the things that go into a business, it's there for that entire duration from the time you're prepping all the way until probably 3 months after every backer has had the game. Because there's going to be all this customer service stuff, even when once they get the game, it's missing a piece or it's got
my box corner is dinged.
Exactly. So plan on it being at least a year of your life that you are running a business. So if you don't want to run a business, don't run a Kickstarter.
There was another recently a company folded. I think they had gone over budget on their first one, and they were basically funding the previous game with their next Kickstarters. And after 3 or 4 of them, they ended up just running out of money completely and Golden Gopher, is that, does that mean anything to you?
Something I've seen multiples. I funded two Kickstarter campaigns from Fifth Street Games, and they went under. And so they had like Farmageddon, that was one of their titles, which was in retail and was selling, and they could reprint it and keep selling that game that that Grant Rudick did. It was a fun game, but they had not, they had gone bananas with stretch goals on multiple campaigns, and they had not budgeted things out, and their whole company went under and took all the games with it.
And what the situation you described where you do one campaign and then you do another one and then you use some of the money from the second one to fund the first one and then you do a third one to fund the second one, that's a problem of cash flow. And that's just like, you know, running a business. And it's kind of, it may be a little, I don't know, if we'll go into that now. I won't go into it unless people have questions about it.
I will say that as a rule, I have a rule now, I've been learning this lesson, that I will not back your Kickstarter, your second Kickstarter campaign, if you have not completely fulfilled your first one. So if I, you know, backed your first one and I haven't received it yet, like, oh, it started shipping, I'm not going to back your second one. And so that's now a hard rule that I've done, because there are the serial guys that go out there and they do three and they haven't shipped any of them and then they never ship. And so that can happen too. All right, I want to take a question from the audience. What question do you have about Kickstarter? I'm going to take this gentleman on the right.
This may be a bit out of scope, but you said the first mistake when starting a Kickstarter is not having a company. When you say start a company, it seems like there would be a lot of steps going into that. Is it like a quick, easy, like, what do you do to start a company?
This is a question for our lawyer.
Yeah, I mean, you hire a lawyer to form your LLC, or I guess you could go to something like LegalZoom or something like that. I mean, obviously, I don't recommend that because, well, they just don't have a hands-on approach. They won't answer your questions. They won't, you know, if someone works with me, I will, you know, they send me an email and I'll get back to them and let them know, what, you know, and sometimes it's irrelevant to the company itself. It has to do with other things or whatever. And I don't mind doing that. It's more personal, right? You have a point of contact where you can talk about it. A LegalZoom won't do that.
And I'll back you up on that. I've started 19 businesses myself. Mm-hmm. And I have used LegalZoom and I've used attorneys for doing it. And your first time out, you want to use an attorney because they will walk you through stuff.
Sure.
Later, if you start another hobby business and you want to just skip all the steps and use LegalZoom, go for it. But that first time, use an attorney.
It comes down to, you know, what is your time worth? You know, you can look up. I mean, any person can form an LLC on their own. I don't know. Well, you know, are you going to spend hours and hours researching it, understanding how to do this, finding templates for the things, and then changing your agreements and all that stuff? It really, your time is better spent making the game and making the game better and letting someone else handle
it. And you'll be doing it using internet legal advice, not real, you know,
like
advice from
an
attorney.
No.
I would, gentlemen over here, had a question?
I was kind of curious about stretch goals. So let's say you put your game out and you say $30 a copy, right? But then you start, you know, getting a lot of backers and you get close to a stretch goal. Well, that game's still $30, but now you're putting in components that make it more expensive.
Yep.
Because you're about to hit another, like a price break in bulk. Is that how you make the difference back?
Yeah, component upgrades, I'll have a high tolerance for. So component upgrades, because if you're saying, hey, if we make this much money, we're going to upgrade to a thicker chipboard, or we're going to put a linen finish on our cards, and that is not going to substantially change our shipping weight. And if it may not substantially change your production cost if you're now getting a price break because you're printing more copies. So as you go up a tier and the print quotes you're going to get for a larger print run manufacturer, we're going to give you like, okay, if you print this many copies, the price per copy is going to be this. But if you print this many copies, we give you a break and it'll be slightly less, be this. So you can actually, or you can look at that your sunk costs, your art or your graphic design you paid for or the marketing you paid for is now distributed across more copies. And so how much money you're going to make per copy is now higher. You can afford to spend that on better components inside the box. Does anybody else want to weigh in on that?
Well, to be honest, also stretch goals are, especially now, used more as just a let's keep the excitement going for a campaign.
Yep.
And it's not even about the cost anymore. You know, and that's where the cost comes from. You know, if you funded 1,000 backers, now you have 2,000 backers, you can now print 1,000 more copies, and then you're going to get a, you know, each copy maybe will cost $1 less. Now you have $1,000 to play with. So that's where it comes from. But to be honest, I mean, it's more about keeping it interesting for people and having goals that they can accomplish and, you know, like a reason to share it with friends and that kind of thing.
Mark.
Yeah. To be honest. Yeah.
I don't do crazy stretch goals where, you know, anything's going to add lots of money to the thing. So I actually build in the cost of every single stretch goal that I have planned from day one, because then if I don't get the stretch goals, at least I have some more money in my pocket, you know, for that. So, and if I do get the stretch goals, I've paid for them. So either way, win.
Yeah. But if it's your first one, you know, and you're going for a bare minimum number of backers,
sure,
you know, playing around with that maybe isn't.
I would say if it's your first one, avoid stretch goals like a plague. Mm.
Yeah.
Or do stretch goals that cost you nothing to fulfill. They're digital stretch goals.
Right.
Hey, when we hit this level, well, I'll pay our artist to make 5 wallpapers for your computer. Or we hit this stretch goal, we're going to give you a downloadable PDF that has a co-op scenario or an alternate way to play. And that costs you – it's linked off your website. That costs you – maybe you pay the artist to do the artwork or the graphic designer to do the layout for your PDF. And it costs you nothing to ship out or mail it or manufacture that. And that gives you something else you can give backers that didn't cost you anything to distribute.
But I guess most importantly, make sure that you have a quote for those stretch goals. Don't just get a quote without them and then know that, oh, other campaigns have done this and they've added this. And then I'm going to do it too because I'm sure it'll work. You know, get the quote from your manufacturer for everything to make sure that it's not going to increase the price of each copy by $2 because you're not going to be able to cover that in just economies of scale. So, along
the same lines, if there was a component upgrade you want to put in, are we better off doing that as an add-on versus...
Ooh. Add-ons are a nightmare in themselves.
Yeah. Even if you're an established person, don't do add-ons.
I'll give you the add-on answer we got yesterday from the guy who works for Panda GM, and he goes, if you're going to do something like that, now you're getting quotes from me. You want to manufacture this many copies of the game with this version, with these components, and this many copies with this version. And let's say that only 50 people back the add-on version, you know, but you have 1,000 backers for the regular version. So now what are you going to do? How are you going to make 50 copies of that when my minimum order is 1,500 and you're already printing with me? Now how are you going to pay 1,500 of the special version and try to sell them somewhere else? Yeah. And so that can be really rough.
If it's your first campaign, don't do a deluxe version and a regular version. If you do it that way, make sure that – don't do that.
Maybe we can also talk what's some more, you know, helpful hints for your first campaign, right? Because have you not run a campaign yet? Is that why you came? Okay. I mean – if you're doing your first campaign,
my favorite piece of advice to give those who are interested in learning about Kickstarter is that you're going to get a lot of advice from other creators, and don't take what they say at face value. Don't say if they say this is how you have to do it, that's wrong, because that might be right for them where they are, but it's not right necessarily for a first creator. It's going to be right possibly for a small card game, but it's not going to be right for a big box game or vice versa. So think about where they're coming from, because what they say is the way to do it, the way you have to do it. It's not right for everybody. So
I want to get the question in the front row.
Yeah. So you mentioned in the beginning, like running a crowd funding without a crowd. Mm-hmm. And I read, starting to read Jamie Stigmeier's book. He was, if you distill his suggestion, his main idea to get a crowd is basically starting a blog and starting to write about the things which people may find useful. Mm-hmm. But not all of us are great writers. So my question is, what are the ways you see to get your crowd, which you then convert into backers?
You can pay people to write for you. You can pay people to write posts for you.
How can I add value and build a crowd? So maybe if I have a good game, I take it to cons, and it's in the first exposure playtest hall, it's in the prototype area, I take it to Protospiel, and I add, hey, if you like the game, sign up for my mailing list, and I'll let you know when the game launches. So maybe my game is what's driving my acquisition of a crowd. Maybe I'm a terrible writer, but I'm an excellent mathematician. And so what I put on my blog is, here is a solo play scenario for a game that's normally not solo play. And you can get that from me. Maybe I'm an artist, And I'm not again not a writer, but I'm a good artist. I could say, hey, I made these icons or this generic fantasy artwork or this generic medieval artwork that you can use in your prototypes. And that's what you come to my website for, to get this resource that I provide. And that's what I'm building my crowd.
You can also engage someone else's crowd.
So, yep.
For example, in the Game Crafter community, we have 100,000 plus, it's like 113,000 game designers and game buyers in that community. And a lot of people, how they co-opt our crowd. So what they'll do is they'll come in, get involved in the chat or the community contests or any number of the community things that we do. They'll build a following within that group so that when they launch their campaign, they have 100 people that they have that they've made friends with and that they have supported through that community. And I'm not saying you have to use the GameCrafter community. Any community that you are a member of already or that you can join, you can co-opt their crowd by being active in that crowd. So.
And I would distill his book and his lessons as more build a community rather than build a crowd. So just get involved in a community or try to build one yourself around something. And yeah, it could be on YouTube. It doesn't have to. Yeah, it could be anything. Just to try to be involved in the community and help others any way you can.
Brian built some of his crowd through YouTube strategy videos, yeah. Right? So his strategy, hey, here's how to win. When your buddies buy this game, here's how to beat them. And so that was that was his video, and that he built some following through that.
Yeah.
I could be building a crowd in real life, that I'm the guy who hosts the weekly game night and teaches you all these games,
yep, right.
Or goes to the local cons and is teaching people the hot new games.
Yep.
And like, oh, I know that guy. He taught me that game. He was really nice. I'd be happy to at least, you know, back him for $5.
And Jeremy starts, you know, has run a couple of conventions, you know, so he's created more community in the San Francisco Bay Area than anyone I know. So he's that guy that everybody goes to learn the newest game, but also, you know, to learn more about game design or, you know, teach people anything about game history.
And to build a community, you cannot be a vampire. You have to be constantly giving, mm-hmm. So that when you ask, it's meaningful.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's it.
Yep.
Yeah, now if Jeremy asks me to do anything, you know, I owe him like 10,000 times over. So I'm there for him.
I'll take the question all the way to the back. Ooh.
How many prototypes do you send out? Obviously, it's not going to be a cold send. You're going to make contact with people and get involved with your blog or whatever.
Yep. So hopefully I've read that reviewer's blog or looked at their channel,
right.
And I understand their audience. Is it a family audience? Is it a casual audience? Is it the hardcore audience? And then when I write them, I mention that and saying, hey, I have this game. It's coming to Kickstarter. I'd like to send you a review copy. I think it would be great for your audience because... And I relate it to their crowd. That I show that I understand their review channel, and that I'm going to fit within that. And I may I've seen some people do is that I have a giveaway. The review copy. I'm going to send you two review copies. One for you to use. Another one to give away to the followers on your blog that I made through the Game Crafter. And so now they get a giveaway for that to drive engagement through their channel, and that adds value to them. How many to send out? I know Brian's been experimenting with this, sending out copies to different reviewers, and some reviewers get more views than others. Some are more reliable than others. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, definitely. One thing I'll say before I give that answer is don't just ask them to review something. Before you do that, spend a lot of time commenting on their videos, their blog posts,
right.
Engaging with them in that way, because then when you come to them, they'll recognize you. And if you're a content creator, there's nothing you want more than people interacting with the things that you created. Mm-hmm. So that's the best way you can build that connection with them so that you can continue that. And that's just one part of it is that maybe they'll want to review your game or preview your game. So I have done it. So I use the Game Crafter to create. That's the latest version of our games when we go through development. We always have the latest game version uploaded to the Game Crafter And then we start out with playtesters, and we send out for our latest latest game. We sent out about 60 copies of them through the GameCrafter copies. And so all I did, I uploaded that previous version once, and then when I asked who wanted copies, and I started sending those out, I just, you know, basically hit a button, and then they all went out to all those playtesters. And then that's one way to start it. That's going to be expensive, so I did ask, you know, for them to pay for some of it, and I paid for a good part of it too.
You subsidized it.
I did. Yep. So that's one start. And then when you ready for the next step to get ready for your campaign, you can start doing preview actual like reviewers who will do an official preview for you, and that could be a video or a blog. And for some games, I've sent out 30 copies to, you know, for different previewers. And then I can choose which ones I want to put up on a Kickstarter campaign page. I can take the best. I could also send out, you know, you want two or three probably on your campaign. So I could also just send out two or three. But then those are the ones that are going on my page. They might not be very positive. They might not be very excited. They might not get it to me on time. So I would err on the side of sending it to more. But each copy you send out does cost money. It's not free. So you do have to be careful there too. It'd be better if you can build that relationship with a few, maybe 10. And if you have that strong relationship with them, they're not going to let you down. They're going to review that game. They're going to give it an honest review, and they're going to do it before your campaign launches. As long as you give them a reasonable amount of time, give them 2 months to do it, at least.
JT, is there a way I could help? I could find reviewers through the GameCrafter.
I like to give a reviewer 6 days.
Yeah.
No, 2 months is the minimum. But yeah, on the GameCrafter, you can click help in the main menu, and there is a link in there. You can search for reviewers and a whole bunch of other types of people too. But I think there's 30 or 40 reviewers on our page that review indie titles. And so each one of them, we put a little blurb on there as well about the types of things that they review. So pick the reviewer that best fits your game, or reviewers that best fit your game, because you know, if you're making a game about sex and violence, you probably don't want to send it to Father Geek. He does family games, so you know, that sort of thing.
In the glasses, she's been waiting all day.
I was wondering, so for reviews, how do you put them on the Kickstarter? Do you actually just like kind of put one after the other at the bottom of the Kickstarter? I mean, you don't remember seeing a lot of reviews.
Let me broaden that question. Let me ask, so I'm structuring my Kickstarter page from top to bottom. What does it look like from top to bottom? So if you're thinking, you're visualizing in your head from top to bottom, what does my Kickstarter page look like? Specifically for you two gentlemen, what is the order that things go in?
Depends on the game. Everything is, you know, there isn't just a one-size-fits-all. So what do you want to highlight first about your game? Don't throw people into the nitty-gritty details. Give them, there are a lot of people are only going to read the first two sentences of your campaign page. And if there isn't enough there to make them keep reading, they're going to go find something else. They're going to get distracted by something else. So get something there right away, draw their attention. But then as you keep going down, you need to, again, don't just throw them into the mechanics right after that either. Give them a little more and a little more. And you need to make that page come alive. If you're not a graphic designer, you might want to hire one to do that. But if you have some skills, you might be able to do it on your own. But that presentation, that's how, if you don't give them a good enough reason to buy on that page, they're not going to do it. It's kind of your one chance. You need to put a lot of effort into that campaign page. So
you have the teaser video and then the information about the game and then the stretch goals after that, right?
In general order, I'm not sure where reviews go. So I'll answer this as the backer, from the backer perspective.
Yeah.
When I go to a page, I want to see, sometimes I'll watch the video, sometimes I won't. I will read the first half page of copy on the page. And I want it to sell me on the game, tell me the theme and the general mechanics of the game right up front. And then I want to know how many players is it and how long does it take to play. And often there'll be a little strip there that tells me the number of players and the play time. And sometimes there's not. And that really annoys me if I don't know, is this a two-player game? Is it how? Do I have to watch your video to find out how many players? So I want to know that right up front. I want to know what's the theme. And then I want to know what's the hook. Why is this game special or different or interesting? And that's what I'm looking to hit in the first half page. And then I will, if that gets me, I will then scroll down. I'll look to see if you have any reviewers. I expect those to be lower down, maybe even near the bottom. That's just like an endorsement that, hey, this guy knows what they're doing, that they actually have someone reviewed their game. They're not, you know, coming out of nowhere. And I also like to see your team, something that's more important to me now. I like to see I've seen other guys do that I really appreciate is like a four-paragraph blurb with people's photos. Hey, this is our designer. This is our artist. This is our graphic designer. And I look at that and I go, oh, Adam MacGyver is working on this, or Beth Sobel is working on this. And that gives me more confidence in your project. If I see that little bio section there, I want to see that as well. So those are the things that I look. I want to know upfront, you know, what's the theme of your game? What's the hook? Why am I interested? Number of players, the play time. And then later down, I want to see your team and I want to see your reviews. I don't give a rip about your stretch goals.
So to answer our question, if there are a number of reviews, let's say you get 10 reviews, are they just going out in backer updates and things like that, and they're not necessarily all on
the page? No, I think they're going to be in the main page. They're going to be lower down. They're going to be like one-line quotes, like a movie poster. Mm-hmm. That may be a paragraph.
I don't even put the full sentence. I just get the best little meat.
Okay. And then a link back to the review so that it's legit. And sometimes I see a YouTube video embedded of the video review. And you know, one or two of those is fine. I don't want to scroll down and scroll through five videos. That's probably going to drive me nuts. I'd rather see the one best video and then links to the other ones.
Whoever has the most hits, I guess. The most
or who did the best presentation. You know, because I may watch the review video may be more valuable to me than your Kickstarter video, which may be all animated and fancy, and you hired a video production guy to do that, but doesn't tell me a lot about how to play the game. Right. Whereas the reviewer, like, oh, I know this reviewer. He's going to run me through your game in 2 minutes. I'll watch his video review because I'm going to get a good impression of the game.
My structure is I have a what's this section, which is one paragraph that's just the pitch of what is the game. And that's, you know, directly below the Kickstarter video. The next section is the game components. I want you to see those right away because I try to make visually striking games. The next thing I put is the vitals, which is the how many people does it play and that sort of stuff. And then I put reviewers, actually. So mine is relatively close to the top. And again, I just take the meat. It's like the best four words that this reviewer said, their name linked to their site. And that's it for the reviewers. And then I move into the how to play section, which includes at the top, it's a how to play video and then text version of the video with images. And then a bunch of crap after that. But those are my...
That sounds pretty good to me. And I'll endorse, if your game is not like a simple card game, a photo where all the components are laid out on a table, and I see everything that I get all lay spread out, that I do appreciate as well. That kind of that big spread photo, mm-hmm. I think, is a necessity as well. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to take one from the gentleman over here on the far right.
I know that you don't like stretch goals. What about backer rewards? Things like $1 level, $10 level, $25 level, et cetera.
Ah, different pledge levels.
How do you feel about that, and what are some ideas for pledge goals just in general that could be useful for game designers who don't really have a lot of bells and whistles to send out?
That's a great question. I want to take a crack at it, and then I want to ask you guys as well. So if you have too many pledge levels on the right, it's confusing, and I get turned off by your campaign. So I think maybe 5 to 7 is the most I'd want to see, and simple, I think, is better. You do want a $1 level because a lot of people are going to back you for $1. And like so James Matthews says, you should have that $1 level. I'll back some campaigns for $1 just because I want to follow them or look at them. And that's $1 they get. Or if one of my games is on Kickstarter, what I like to tell my designer friends is say, hey, come back me for $1. They'll say, hey, man, I'm broke. I'm eating tuna. I can't back your game. Like, fine, you can give me $1 and raise my backer count and make my crowd look more impressive. So definitely want to have the $1 level. And then you want to decide if you want to do a print and play level. There are a lot of people who will back you at the print and play level. And there's different thoughts about how much that should be. If that's $5 or $20. I like a cheaper print and play level because all I'm getting is a PDF. But if you have like a $5 or $10 print and play level, then if I'm interested in your game but I'm not certain, I will probably back you at that level. And then if like in an update the backer only is going to see I have a link to that print and play level, now often I'll go download that print and play and look at it and see, does this game look good? Am I actually going to up my pledge to doing a full level? Now, someone could back at the print and play level, download it, and then cancel. And that's the risk you take. And what Brian has recently changed from was doing limited art print and play to full art print and play, because a lot of people want to see the print and play to check out how good your art is. So if your print and play is impressive, you're more likely to get them to come back and up for the full game. And so those are the levels I think that you want to have the $1 level, you probably want to have a print and play level, and then you want to have your game level. You may, I'll ask these guys what they think of the retailer level, the 5 or 10 copies level. And see, I've used that once because a bunch of my buddies wanted to buy the game too. Like, oh, let's buy the 5 copy or 10 copy level. We all save, you know, a couple bucks. But we'll ask these guys what they think of the pledge levels. How do you structure your pledge levels? Do you have a low level? Do you have a print and play level?
I have I generally have 2 levels. I have a $1 level, and actually I give people something for that. I actually take some of the art from the game and make a wallpaper out of it. And about halfway through the campaign, I will throw out the first wallpaper, and about 3/4 of the way, I'll throw out the second one. But that's the dollar level, what you get. And then my second level is the game. My third level, if I have a third level, depends on the campaign, but it's generally a bundle. So in the case of, for instance, The Captain is Dead, episode 3 is coming out in about a month here. I'm going to have that up on Kickstarter. And it's episode 3, right? So I will have a bundle level that you can get 1, 2, and 3 all as one thing for a low price. Not like super low.
Lower price.
But a lower price than if you bought them all individually. And so that's it. I don't do the print and place mainly because my games are fairly complicated and nobody's going to actually
assemble
all that stuff. So, it's just not worth my time to actually put it together. But I do put a crap ton of art on the page so they can see the art. But that's it. I keep it really, really simple. I don't want anything complicated. The retailer level, no way. I've talked to too many retailers about it. I actually did a poll on – there's a retailer forum on Facebook just with retailers, and I actually polled them. And every one of them, with the exception of – I think there were 2 out of the 100 or so that responded that said they would back that. Everybody else said, fuck no.
If I was starting my first campaign today, I would do a $1 level, a print and play level, and the game. That's it. Once, you know, with Good Cop, Bad Cop, we have some expansions for it, so I'll do a bundle for that because so many people want that. They are just, you know, they need the base game and the expansion, that kind of thing. So I'll do bundles for that. But it adds a lot of complexity to your fulfillment plan, because you need to make sure those enough copies of each thing that they got go to the right fulfillment centers that you're using for your fulfillment. It makes things a lot more complex. So I will do just those. Now, if I were to do one, I would also do a standard version and a deluxe version. But that isn't something that I would recommend for
that's the experienced publisher.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll say that Kickstarter, hopefully people know this, maybe not, you can push updates by pledge level. So I can push an update that only the print and play people say. And I can say, hey, we got 72 hours left. Now is a great time to move from the print and play level to the full level. And I can push. If I have people at that $1 level or the print and play level, I can push an update that just emails them.
And for the retailer too, I will just say – I've tried the retailer level or the, you know, 5 copies or 10 copies, but almost nobody does it. And if a retailer is interested, they don't want whatever number I decided to put on the page, the 5, the 10. They want 25 or 30, or they want a certain number, 12. So I just tell them back for $1, and then we'll talk after, you know, once the campaign funds. Just let me know how many you want, and then I'll get it to you.
What about a $10,000 lunch with Brian Adams?
Right.
How about the vanity one?
Right.
Put yourself in the game. You pay $200, and our artist puts you as one of the characters in the game. How do you guys feel about the vanity level? Let me ask you guys first, and then I'll comment on that.
I've done it. Have you done it? You've done it?
I went super simple, though. I didn't let them choose art that was going into the game. I just said you get to name something in the game.
And how much was that?
I think it was an extra $20 or something.
Okay.
It was a $50 game, and you had to pay $70 to do that. And I had 10 or 12 of them. It wasn't like a huge number of things or anything. And I sold out.
How fast?
Within the first week, they were all sold. So, why not collect those extra couple $100 for that? But I wouldn't do art because generally I have all the art done before the campaign, and art costs a lot of money versus a piece of text in the card or whatever. It doesn't cost anything.
What did they get to name?
In this game, it was Parkies. It's a theme park game, and so you're getting to name the various rides that were in the game. So,
I showed
the art of what the ride is, and then they could put whatever name they wanted on it.
I would worry about my creative control. You know, what if they did something,
You had final editorial.
Okay.
Get a refund the $20 if you had to.
But even if it wasn't one, like, you can't really find any good reason to say no, but you're just like, oh, I don't want a ride called, that in the game.
The roller coaster.
I didn't care.
Yeah.
Brian, vanity levels.
Yeah, I've done it before. So, like, Bombers and Traitors, an expansion to Good Cop, Bad Cop, we let people be cops in the game. What happened was the campaign ended. So, I mean, I got, 100, it was, base level might have been $14 for, a copy. And then to be in it, it was, 100, $125.
And you sold out within under an hour, I think, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was very, very quick. But then at the end of the campaign, I didn't know if those backers would stay in it through the end. So before I got pictures from them and assigned those to my artist, I had to wait till the campaign ended, make sure that they paid, then get pictures from everybody, send those to the artist. He had other projects going on. So now, I have 20 people that he needs to draw into the game. And that can be, it can be months and months and months before I can submit. I can finalize the graphic design after I get all the illustrations, get it to my printer, and then now we can actually start doing proofing, and then eventually we'll get to manufacture it. And
it's so delayed your game
so much time to your schedule. And sure, I got maybe $2,000, minus the fees that Kickstarter took out of it and everything, and then I had to pay for that art too, so it wasn't just $2,000 profit. I had to pay for my illustrator to do that.
And then you got some backlash because the people who pledged at the level were almost all white males.
They were, yeah.
And so that put a bunch of white males in the game, and people were like, well, this is not very diverse in your game here.
Yeah.
There's a thing that I back a lot from, not in board game industry, but I back a lot of projects on Kickstarter as well. In technology, a lot of them will provide a pledge level where you pay extra to get it first.
Yeah.
You'll get it a month earlier or 2 months earlier or whatever. And video games do this too for early alpha access versus beta access, whatever. But there are some in the board game industry that do this. And what they'll do is they'll charge double or more. And then you'll get the Game Crafter copy immediately after the campaign. And then you'll get the retail edition 8 months later or a year later or whatever, when they finally get around to the production. But that way, you can start playing that game in a month. And that actually has gone over well. Like, Boss Monster a few years ago did that with us. We put out, 200 copies of Boss Monster that were just, it was the Game Crafter edition. Didn't have all the final everything in it or anything, but 200 people backed for, paid... I think it was triple.
If you charge a premium, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Or I've seen we'll air ship it to you. Yeah. And again, they charge a premium, so it covers the air shipping and more.
Right. Yeah.
Rather than waiting the 6 weeks on the boat, we'll air ship you the copy right away, and you'll have it before any of your friends.
Yeah, right.
And if you use the Game Crafter to do your preview copies or playtest copies,
it's already up there.
You already have it in there, so why not, Then you just ship those out.
I'll say for the vanity levels, the text vanity levels, I've seen a lot. I think those are pretty good. Name something in the game with editorial control because it doesn't delay your production timeline. The art ones, if you're going to do an art one, put your face in the game or put, your favorite pet in the game or something like that, make sure you charge enough money for it that it's viable for you. So I see some of those go for $250 or $500. Sometimes they don't sell. And sometimes people do sell, and so they're like, I'm going to put mine for $500 because that's how much hassle is worth for me. And I sold four of them. That's an extra $2,000 for something I'm going to value at $300 of hassle. That may or may not be worthwhile. Or if you're doing your art yourself, like you're the animator guy, like, man, I can do that.
And beautiful thing is, if it doesn't sell, who cares?
Yeah, it doesn't sell. You're not out at all.
It doesn't cost you anything. So,
So just be aware of the potential fifth balls. I mean, to turn someone down, getting all white males. or delaying your production timeline.
So for me, it's not worth it, and I don't think I would ever do it again. But I can't say that it's not worth it for everyone or any game.
A game I was really excited about. I would pay the triple for a GameCrafter copy and the final copy.
I like that
because I give away games at my monthly game night at raffles. So I would play the GameCrafter copy, and then when I get the full one, I'd raffle off the GameCrafter one, and that I might pay triple for that.
I like that.
All right, let me take the gentleman here on the right.
Real quick, depending on casual or complexity that your game rulebook is, how good of an idea is it to chop a PDF and say, hey, check out the rules?
Have the rules as a PDF on the Kickstarter campaign. I want to say that's a must. And I would say you could say it's a beta. Hey, we're still working on the rules. If you see any errors or have any suggestions, let us know. So you don't have to say this is not the final rules. But a lot of people want to read the rules before they back you, and that costs you almost nothing to put it up there. So I would say it's a must.
Agreed. Yeah, it is a must. I've made a mistake though. The rules, it's especially with your first campaign, it takes way, way longer than you expect every time. So I've made the mistake on a few campaigns of the plan was to have the full final rules out there, but it didn't happen. We couldn't get it done in time, and we had a rule book that was, you know, based off of like a Word document with images in there. It did not look very good. And so we lost presentation points because we didn't have those final rules. And you look at them and it looks like it's unprofessional. And some people don't know that it's a beta. You know, they don't read the fine print and it might make them not back. So start your rules really, really, really early.
I have a solution for that I use. In every page of the document, it's, you know, at the bottom of the page, you have page number, it's 9, page 9, page 8, whatever. Right next to every page number, I also say beta rules version 1.6 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that way they know what edition of the thing they have and they know that there's going to be more edits.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can actually upload your rules to the GameCrafter and pay someone to review them and give you feedback on improving your rules. That's a service you guys offer, I've used before.
$30
to get an editor to review your rules and improve them. I think it's worth the $30. Yep. I would also say if you can do a how to play video and a how to play video that you either embed in your page or you link to from your rules. A lot of people don't like to read rules, so they will watch the how to play video. And if the how to play video has a GameCrafter early copy of your game, so it looks like the final game, that's a big perk to do as well.
That editor thing is called the sanity test. Yep. If you're looking for it on our site. Yep.
The sanity test, and it takes a while, so plan ahead to make sure that it goes through.
Yeah, it could be a couple of weeks before you get it back, but
I'm gonna take this gentleman under the glasses.
What about like third party guys like Backer Kit and Pledge Managers and fulfillment houses and stuff like that?
Third party backer kits after the fact.
Did you use them?
I've never used them, and I hate it every time I deal with it with somebody else's pledge. But that's me. I don't know.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah,
I'm not a big fan of those pledge managers. I think they can scrape up some extra money for you because people add on another copy or add on some something. But
it's
for
a
me,
sign to me that they made their campaign too complicated.
And I have to go in and make another account and password and jump through these extra hoops to get my game versus someone who doesn't do that. And Kickstarter sends me an email: "Is your address correct?" Yes, I'm done. Yay! That's much. Yeah, they're a hassle. I don't generally like them.
I've used BackerKit before. Yeah, it was good and bad. They do make it easier if you're not taking our advice and you add a lot of add-ons and multiple reward tiers. If you do that, then you probably do need something like that, a pledge manager, to keep it all straight and to do all the formatting in the end. Yeah,
but don't do that.
I just backed a campaign called Vikings Gone Wild, which is a MOBA game, a video game they converted into a board game. So I backed this game because it looked interesting, and they sent me to a French backer kit thing, and the terms and conditions are in French and not in English. I don't even know what I'm signing, so I haven't gone through that yet. And now I've seen multiple updates on the Kickstarter. Oh yeah, we put the terms and conditions up in English. Now, oh, please give it another try. Please go through our backer kit thing, because people are like, this looks really sketchy. I don't even want to do this thing. So now maybe they have backers who they can't fulfill because the backer's like, I don't understand your backer kit system, or it looks suspicious to me, and I don't want to use it.
And add-ons are okay with certain games. I guess I shouldn't say that. It's more for our games that add-ons don't work, and that it's not worth it for me, but. Some games there are. If you have like a minis game, you might be able to add on another mini, and that would make sense, and people will do it. People get really excited, and then you can use something like BackerKit, and people will add them on later, and you can make a lot more money at the end when the game is funded. They see all the really cool stuff that you did, and oh, I want these three minis, or I want this little expansion pack or something, or you have a related game or something, or, you know, there's a lot of things that do make sense to add on that people are going to want. It's going to be a heck of a lot of work for you to do it, but if you do want that option for people, you're going to sell a lot more through something like a BackerKit, and then they'll take a percentage of it or a flat fee for each one sold. They have some different pricing models, but so they'll take a cut of it, but it's going to be money that you wouldn't get otherwise.
Let me flip this. There is the pre-campaign add-on system. One of them is Prefundia, where I follow a game I'm interested in Prefundia, and then I get a notification when it launches. Another one is to do a Kickstarter preview. You know, I put my campaign up as a preview, and I send that out to people. Do you use any pre-campaign systems or services like that?
Just the one built into Kickstarter?
The one, the Kickstarter preview? Use that one? How far in advance?
As early as I possibly can. As soon as that page is even close to done, I'm linking it everywhere.
Yep, me too. I've done that in the past. I've done that. You make your campaign page, you get a preview link, and then people can look at it and give you feedback. So I do I've done that. The same thing. I post that link absolutely everywhere. I want as many people to know about it, give me advice about, you know, what they want to see that isn't there.
I should say I have a pre-step. So I do that,
what
I just said. But I also, before I link it everywhere, I actually go into the GameCrafter chat, post it there, and say, hey, guys, take a look at this. So I get a little bit of pre-feedback for about 30 minutes and make sure that I haven't done something ridiculously stupid.
Right.
And then I put it out.
Yeah. Hey, all your pledge levels are $1.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
But I've also used I've started using Prefundia lately. It works for me. It's not going to work for everybody. I wouldn't – It could work for a first-time creator. The key, I guess, is that you need a way to drive a lot of people to that page. Otherwise, you're going to get 10 people before you launch, and it's just not going to be very useful. And you have to go through the time to create it. But if you're out there demoing for, you know, a year or 2 years before your launch to build your crowd, it's nice to have to send them there. So, like, our next game, Leaders of Euphoria, I bought the domain leadersofeuphoria.com, and now I can put that in everywhere when I demo the game. And people can go, and it's super easy. It redirects them to Prefundia, and now they can take an action when they play that game a year before it comes out. And they're like, this was a fun game. If you want to, right after they get done, they can just now just put their email address in there. They'll get one email when you launch, and then all those people, you didn't do that demo, you know, a year or 2 years ago for nothing. You know, you got some interest in it then, and then got them to take some action there, and then when it goes live, they might want to back it.
I'll say we're almost out of time. Who's game to hang out afterwards in the hallway?
Trent for a little bit.
Okay. So Brian has time's Trent as a publisher, but I'll be out in the hallway with these guys afterwards. We're running out of time to answer additional questions. I've got time to maybe take one more, and then we've got to call it a day.
What's a good free Kickstarter budget, and should you roll that cost into Kickstarter itself?
Oh, so
$1 billion.
I want to phrase this as we've been asked before: is do you set a real goal on Kickstarter or do you set a fake goal? And the real goal is to actually pay for my art and fund the game and actually print it and ship it. I need this much money. Versus a fake goal is I'll make that lower and I'll cover some out of pocket if I fund. And because I'm gonna plan to make that money later, selling my extra copies or in retail or something like that. A real goal versus a fake goal, and what does that goal look like?
I set a real goal based on my production costs, but not my sunk costs. So like, I buy all of the art up front, no matter what, just because I want it to be there because I feel like it helps me get more backers to have all that art right there. So I don't put that in as my base funding goal because my base funding goal is always like $5,000. I go for the lowest possible goal I can do and still hit the production and still, you know, hit production levels so that I don't lose money. But I'm not at that very minimalist thing. I'm also not trying to make money, you know, other than a little bit of a buffer. But I don't build in the art costs. And that means that in certain campaigns, I risk losing the $3,000 or whatever that I put into artwork. But I'm okay with that because it's not going to bankrupt me. If it would bankrupt you, don't do that. That's just the nature of the beast. But I'm willing to take that risk because of who I am. You need to build it according to who you are. But I would definitely start with the lowest funding goal you can possibly hit that will cover whatever costs you are comfortable needing and every 100% of the production and shipping costs. Don't eat any of that. So.
Yeah, that's the right answer, I think, for a first-time creator, too. But for the last, you know, year and a half, it started to get harder and harder to fund your first campaign on Kickstarter. So, I mean, I was lucky enough to get in before then, and now it's hard, and it's going to be really hard to make those actual real goals for a lot of games, which is why I would not... I would never, ever, ever start your first campaign with a big box game.
Nope.
I would make a 54-card game or an accessory to an existing game, something very small to start building your crowd. If you try to kickstart a big game, you're going to lose money almost, you know, 100%. You're going to lose money. And it's going to be – there's so many issues with it. So just create a small thing. And start building a crowd and build a slightly bigger thing and then keep going that way. For my first campaign, I did do it so that I did use real, but this is, you know, 2.5 years ago. I did use, you know, real goals. It did, my stretch goals were real stretch goals. You know, the amount that I put on in there was exactly what I was going to need to make this game. And everything was in there. But now I don't do that because now, as a more established publisher, I don't need to, and I'm going to fund any... I now set my goal to how much I think I can get in the first weekend, because I want to fund, and I want to fund early, and I want people to say, oh, wow, funded game, easy, I don't need to worry about it, I'm just going to back and jump on the train. But that's not what you should think about for a first-time publisher. For a first-time publisher, try to do it, but then again, now it's getting harder that you might have to invest some of your personal money to make this dream happen if you don't take my advice and do a small game first.
And because that bandwagon effect, I go look at this game and they have a $40,000 goal, which maybe is a realistic goal for their big box game, and they have $6,000, like, they're not going to make it. I don't know if I'm going to back it. Or maybe I do the remind me in 48 hours and I'll check on them and see if they made it. Now I hop on the bandwagon.
Yep.
Otherwise, I say no, versus you set the fake goal and you fund. And now more people hop on the bandwagon, but if you don't get enough to hit your real goal, now you're on the hook and you're losing money.
Yep.
All right, I got to wrap up. Thank you very much for coming. We'll be hanging out in the hall for a little while to take additional questions. If you have tickets, we'll give them to Zach so he gets Gen Con points. And that's it. Thank you very much for your time.